المنازل كلها شبابيك وانت العيد دل وتمسح الجبين بالسنابل ترى انت وصال
Ray Hanania.
This is Ali Yunus.
Hey, Ali, how are you?
I'm good.
Good morning.
How are you? So
but welcome to Radio Bellity, everybody. Our website is RadioBellity.com. We're brought to you by Ziad Brothers Importing at Ziad.com and Michigan accident attorney Jumana K. Ruse at JumanaKRuse.com, Jake's Candy, and also Icon Computers. We also want to tell you you can listen to our radio show by tuning in to Radio Aramica on RadioAramica.com or using your cell phone by dialing 712-432-8008. And remember, our number this morning is 248-557-3300. Allie, I think we have a guest on, Pamela Olson. I don't know if you had a chance to read her book, but you got to read it. It was just a great book. It's called Fast Times in Palestine. Pamela Olson. She's on the West Coast, way West Coast. Hey, good morning, Pamela.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey. Thank you for joining us on radio here.
It's a pleasure.
Listen, tell us about your book. I read it. I thought it was very compelling. I couldn't put it down. It was a great book. And what really impressed me was the quality of the writing as well as the topic. Instead of focusing on a lot of the anger that sometimes, you know, dominates our writing and message, you kind of just told, hey, I'm here for two and a half years. This is what I saw. And I don't think we do enough of that. Why did you go down there?
Why did I go to Palestine?
Yeah.
Well, after college, you know, I studied physics in college. And then afterwards, you know, I realized, partly because I had studied abroad in Moscow, that, you know, just learning the language in the morning and using it in the afternoon and learning about the Chechen War from Chechen refugees and from mothers of soldiers and, you know, later from the soldiers themselves when I took a train across Siberia, you know, going back to the physics lab in the basement, you know, dimly lit building just wasn't really viable anymore for me. So after I graduated, I decided to just take a couple of years and, you know, do what I found out that I loved, which was travel and write and, you know, keep learning about politics and languages and this kind of thing and just see where it went. And if it didn't go anywhere, then that's fine. I'll get a normal job like anyone else. But, so when a friend, you know, after about a year of making money, you know, saving it to travel, a friend asked if we wanted to meet in Egypt to travel together. So we did, and for about 3 weeks just did touristy things. And then he left, and I went on to Amman, Jordan, and there I met a couple of guys who were doing work in the West Bank in a village called Jayus. And they told me all these crazy stories of what's going on there that just didn't fit at all with what I'd been told about, you know, this particular conflict.
In America, what you've been told in America.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Well, you've been told in America, right? Like a lot of listeners who are listening to us now who probably heard the same things you've heard, and maybe some of them would be shocked too. But so you get there and see something completely different.
Yeah, like 180 degrees different from what I had expected. I mean, I expected to just sort of like, you know, get into Palestine and it's just a wasteland full of cinder block ruins and angry people and just sort of this, you know, horrible place. But
terrorists going around with machine guns.
Yeah, exactly. But I get there, you know, and we have to walk over a roadblock, you know, to get from a settler road to the bypass, you know, to the smaller road where the Palestinian taxis are allowed. And, you know, immediately there's these men next to taxis, and they said, "Assalamu alaikum, welcome to Palestine, where do you need to go?" And, you know, they take us to they give us a free ride to Jayus, where we're going. And then
Jayus near Jerusalem, I think, isn't it, or Ramallah?
Jayus? It's closer to Nablus, kind of in the northern West Bank.
Okay. I'm not familiar. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. And,
So they're very friendly. You get in there, and it's like, wow, what are you thinking? Are they doing it because they think you're a writer and let's, you know, brown up to her? Or are you thinking, what?
Well, at the time I wasn't a writer. I was a tourist. I mean, nothing more or less than that.
Well, listen, wow, I'm going to tell you something, if I can interrupt you. If you weren't a writer when you got there, you became a great writer in a very short period of time, Pamela, because you're honestly, Ellie, you got to read her book.
Well, I'll get a copy, or if you can send me a copy, I would love to. I'm right about it, too.
And I want all the listeners, you got it. Listen, if you care about Middle East peace and Palestine and justice, you got to read her book, Fast Times in Palestine. And we have the author, Pamela J. Olson, on the line with us, telling her this fascinating story about a regular person, right, Pamela, who just, you met somebody, you decided to go to the Middle East, you end up in Palestine, and you're completely shocked by what you see.
Right. One of the first things that was funny is that, they asked me where I was from, and I said, Oklahoma. And they said, oh, yeah, Oklahoma, that's a dangerous place.
It is a dangerous place.
What?
The Indians might not like it. The Native Americans might think
it's dangerous for Native Americans.
Right. But I wondered, of all, what are they thinking? What are they talking about? And he said, wasn't there a bombing? And I'm like, oh, well, there was one bombing 10 years ago. And he's like, but it was big, but, many people killed. And I'm like, well, sure. It was only the one bombing, Don't worry about us. We're in Palestine right now. You got bigger problems. But it was just an eye-opener that, when you know nothing about a place except its bombings, you tend to define it by that and forget that there's more going on than that,
Yeah.
And when did you...
Because they live in a place where bombing occurs all the time, or arrest or violence. So their lives are interrupted on a daily basis.
And also,
they judge other countries as well, if they live through that or not.
And also her point that, they have this image of Oklahoma, a bombing took place there, the way we judge, the Middle East and Palestine. Some big event took place, and we never allow them to get past it. It's constantly on our minds, no matter what's happening. When was the last time there was a suicide bombing? It's been forever, yet they still keep bringing it up. So at what point did you decide, hey, this is a story, I'm going to write a book about it?
So my first week in Jayus, I saw the olive harvest. I saw the fence/wall that was, in the case of Jayus, isolating about 75% of the land from its owners.
Wow.
I met a guy who spoke Russian, a Palestinian guy who spoke Russian, and we kind of bonded over, speaking our secret language in this conservative village. And all these things kind of happened in my first week, and then I didn't want to leave. I planned to stay for a week, but after all this, and after all the great people I was meeting, I didn't want to leave at all. So I ended up staying for another month, and whatever, I was out of money, I had to go back to the States, but it was clear that as soon as I could, I would go back. And so I went back. I moved to Ramallah, volunteered with a progressive political party called the Palestinian National Initiative, and after like 3 months, I got offered a job as a journalist. 3 more months, Yasser Arafat died. I was tapped to be the foreign press coordinator for Dr. Muzaffar Barghouti, who was running for president against Mahmoud Abbas. And, a friend actually compared me to Forrest Gump with the way I was kind of always in the right place at the right time. And, by the time I left, and, at the end of 2005...
You're not the only one who in our world...
Yeah, you're not the only one. We've been reading about Forrest Gump with Tujan Faisal, right, Ellie? And Jordan, she's been...
She's talking about the King Abdullah of Jordan.
But she doesn't have... But Tujan doesn't have all the facts right, does she?
But she didn't even watch the movie, But she read about it.
All right, go ahead. Sorry, Pamela, go ahead.
Oh, no problem. But, after all of these things happened, and I was in the Gaza Strip for the disengagement... And after all these things happened, I had enough money for enough stories for like 3 books. So the problem was not sort of finding material but paring it down. Like I had a block of marble and I had to turn it into something that, was coherent and sort of got across all the things I wanted to do. And was fun to read and included the romantic subplot in a, careful and true way. So, yeah.
And, The book talks about Muzaffar Barghouti. I remember meeting him. I went there in 2005 to work for the negotiation, the Palestinian Negotiating Support Unit, I think it was called. And I was there 4 weeks working on media. And I remember going to his office and meeting with some people. I'm wondering if we ever met. It might have been around the same time.
He comes to Washington quite often, by the way.
Yeah, he does, and he's a great guy, isn't he, Pam? I mean, you must have been drawn to him right away.
Well, yeah, when he spoke at Stanford, the way that he spoke with such a level head and so eloquently and so just sort of very factually and,
But when you say level-headed and he speaks of a matter-of-factly, is that comparing to other leaders who speak emotionally and with a lot of bravado, or speak the use of emotive language to charge the people up, which is common in the Arab world, especially with the media or journalists, not only the politicians? They always appeal to the emotions of the people versus try to reason with the people or treat the people as adults, that they have brains and minds, and you could reason with them instead of just preaching down to them. Is that what you felt with Dr. Barghouti?
Well, in that case, I hadn't had much contact with Arab leaders.
She hadn't been exposed to the Arabs yet. We hadn't grabbed her. We hadn't put her out.
Well,
I'm going to make Campbell and my fourth wife.
If you want to do that, you got to listen to the show, and they will be exposed to race emotionalism and his preaching.
My tribalism.
Your tribalism.
My Christian Arab tribalism,
right,
as somebody called it. We're on the line with Pamela Olson. She's the author of Fast Times in Palestine. And you can go right on Amazon.com and order this book. You got to go there right away. You got to look her up. She has a great blog called Fast Times in Palestine.wordpress.com. We don't mean to keep interrupting, but the story is just so great. And there are interesting little things about what was the worst moment? Did you ever experience a bad moment where you were going, wow, what did I get myself into?
Yeah, there were a couple. I mean, most of my it's strange because because there were a lot of really bad things, but the overall preponderance of my memories is actually good. Like, you know, I go back whenever I can. I love it. But of course, there were some really terrible times. There were a couple times I feared for my life, both of them because of Israeli soldiers. One was I was coming home from a party around midnight in Ramallah, and our cab, you know, pulled up behind what turned out to be an Israeli army jeep, and a soldier popped out of the top and trained a large caliber gun on our windshield. And it was dark, so we couldn't see that we were foreigners. And, you know, by that time I'd covered enough killings and deaths and that kind of thing that, you know, I knew that people are regularly killed under very questionable circumstances and nobody's ever punished for those deaths. So, you know, it's kind of a trigger-happy environment. And I was afraid that if we reached for our documents, or if my friend, who was a photographer, got the silly idea in his head to try to take a picture of it, like, you know, it could be the end of it.
Yeah, you're thinking an American mindset here. When you're stopped by the police, you have to be very careful with where your hands are, because if you put your hand in your back pocket, it could be mistaken that you try to pull a gun, and you might end up being shot. It happens a lot of times in New York and everywhere, big cities. So to explain to our Arabic viewers, you know, as you're thinking as to why you're afraid to reach out in your pocket, they might be mistaken for taking a gun, and you might get shot.
Right, yeah, it's a very touchy situation all the time, because, you know, I think soldiers often feel like a fish out of water in these areas where they don't really know much about the population, they don't know who they're dealing with, and, you know, they're more concerned with getting home at night than with, you know, and especially, you know, for example, the Gaza Strip has been called a playground for sharpshooters by Israeli soldiers. And it's not quite as bad in the West Bank, but it's another case where, you know, if you get shot or otherwise, you know, I've had friends who've been shot, nobody's ever punished.
Well, let me ask you this, Pamela. I mean, in your experience in Palestine, you know, we know a lot of American foreign or European activists go to Palestine in terms of they have this resistance type trips in there to go up to protect the civilians. But by virtue of being Europeans and Westerners or Americans, they have a level of protection that is not afforded to the native Palestinian population there. So, but your experience, you were more on the political side as opposed to an activist in terms of resisting the occupation, resisting taking Palestinian lands or appropriating Palestinian lands or building walls. Is that you see yourself in that more on the political side, helping Barghouti, helping others in terms of sharpening their messages, exposing what's going on with the occupation for a different type of set of audiences, American audience in particular?
Yeah, that's generally where I focus.
Okay. As you know, This is clearly important, but you think that, does it take that we have to ship all Americans
right.
to Palestine?
I was just going to ask
for them to
question.
Know. And we have to ship, them.
How do we reach the 300 million other Pamela Olsons that are out there, Pamela? We can't all, you know, romance you and sweep you off your feet and, you know, to get you to open your eyes. It's just your transformation. You know, maybe I think you sound, first of all, you sound like a great person. It sounds like a very fair person, too. I read your postings on Facebook. Yeah, not you, Ellie.
Oh, okay.
You're definitely not a fair person. No. We're talking about our guest, Pamela J. Anderson, by the way, as a author of Fast Times in Palestine, because we're on live radio. We want to keep promoting it as much as we can. Pamela, by the way, do you have a website that you want to drive or, you know, direct people to if they want to get information on your book besides the blog I mentioned?
Sure. Like, the hub for everything I do is at pamolson.org. That's PAMOLSON.org.
All right. That'll be where we send them. Pam Olson with an OOLSON.org. PamOlson.org. And, you know, Pamela, what do you think the answer is? I mean, look, you had an image, an impression of Palestine as a typical American. For whatever reason, and in your case, you met somebody, you decided to go to a trip to the Middle East. A lot of people want to go to the Middle East, and Egypt is a big place that they want to go to. And then you get segued into Palestine, and you're just completely blown away, obviously, by it. What do you think we have to do? I mean, is our message getting out to Americans? Obviously, it can't be, right?
It's really tough to do so. I mean, I remember when I first got back from Palestine myself, and I was going to everybody saying, oh, my gosh, you won't believe what I saw in Palestine. And they'd be like, oh, no, I watched CNN. What
Palestine, is that Pakistan?
Yeah, right. And then Pam, they're probably going, oh, come on, you're in love. Everything looks good through the eyes of love, don't they? Isn't that what some people said?
I get that occasionally, but mostly it was just like, you know, you must be brainwashed, you know, by you've gone native, you know, you spent too much time with the Arabs, you know, whatever.
Right, you've gone native, that's a good phrase.
Right.
I don't know, it's just such an overwhelming challenge, because anybody who knows anything about Palestine knows what you've seen. One, the vast majority of Palestinians are great people, they're good people, they're, you know, they're very considerate, they're warm. I've been there so many times, and of course I have relatives, but even the ones that don't know me, and maybe especially the ones that don't know me, they're very welcoming, they're very warm, you know, they open their hearts and their homes, and Americans don't see that, and I think your book helps, you know, to kind of break through that. But what do you think we need to do? I mean, you were there, you were a typical American, you've actually... Now, I'm going to say crossed over. You've seen what I think the truth is, and Allie and I, you know, and a lot of people believe is the truth. What do you think needs to be done? I mean, what do you come back with and say, okay, I wrote a book about it, but what else? What needs to be done, do you think?
Right. So in about chapter 10 of the book, my parents come for a visit, and my mother had never been out of the U.S. before.
Right.
And I had to kind of emotionally blackmail them to do it because I knew they'd put it off and you know, get intimidated or whatever. I was like, Mom, if you love me, you'll come and see what my life is like over here.
Did they think, oh, what happened to our daughter? She's been brainwashed by these people?
Well,
by Arabs.
I was, you know, over enthusiastic about the next thing, and, you know, it'd be like when I wanted a trampoline when I was a kid and I'd get over it, you know, whatever. Because, you know, I left home at 16 to go to a boarding school. That was my choice. And so they think their impression of me was kind of frozen of me at 16. So that's part of what I wanted to go to show them, like, look, you know, it's really, it is what it is. You know, you'll see for yourself.
Well, that's funny you said that, because, you know, the impression of you at 16, most Arab families, they have this image of their children, of their young adults' children or adult children as 5-year-old, you know, so they still treat us as, you're still 5, you're not 30 or 40.
Well, and then plus, listen, you know, even though America claims to be the great democracy, you know, we still have stereotypes, and we really oppress women in this country. And one of the things we do is we go, oh, no, not my daughter. I'm not letting her go to the Middle East. What are you doing?
That's not oppression. That's a totally different, you know, but, you know, any parent, you know, would, should be and is protective killed his or her children. So I think that's what Pamela Olson, I was going to say Pamela Anderson, Pamela Olson is trying to say. I'm not trying to cut you off, right? But speaking of that, you know, how's the link working? Because I got people in my...
No, it works. Mine works.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, the link on the radio show.
Oh, wait, okay, on the website?
On the website, because I got friends from Germany try to listen. By the way, Pam, we have millions of listeners around the world. So.
Oh, and you're talking about the live
broadcast
of the radio show? Okay, they got to download. All you do is click Listen Live. Mm-hmm. For those people who are listening on radio, you just click Listen Live, and it downloads a little plug and an app, and you click that and open it up.
Okay.
And you'll be able to hear us live. So that's what they have to do. They'll download a very small little app that will open up the radio show and broadcast live. You're listening to Radio Ballady here at WNZK AM 690 in Metro Detroit. I'm Ray Hanania.
And I'm Ali Yunus.
And our guest on the line is Pamela Olson. And Pamela has written a great book called Fast Times in Palestine. And it really was eye-opening in a... And I've been a writer for years, and, you know, one of the challenges I've always been frustrating for me is watching how Arabs write sometimes so much emotion. Your book didn't have a lot of that emotion, Pam. It had a lot of observation, but it wasn't, like, emotional, and that's what kept me reading. And I wonder, did you do that on purpose, or is it just, you know, maybe it wasn't an issue with you?
It was an issue for sure. When I talked about Dr. Mustafa Barghouti speaking level-headedly, I was comparing him to the way that I spoke in the dialogue groups because I was so angry by what angered by what I had seen. And not only by what I had seen, but by the fact that nobody would listen. People were saying, oh, you're crazy, that can't be true, whatever. So I contrasted his level-headedness with my emotion at the time when I was first getting started. I ended up leaving. By the time I left Palestine, I compared myself to, like, some piece of metal that had so much static charge on it that I didn't know what was going to happen whenever it got touched off. It took me about 2 years to kind of process all this, you know, all this information, all the emotions, all everything else, so that I could write this book in a way that wasn't just a long scream, you know, that really tried to think what would have reached me before I went to Palestine. You know, like an outpouring of emotion, it would have been too intimidating and too overwhelming, and I don't think I would have connected to it.
And sometimes you do want to, you know, it gets frustrating. You just want to make a loud scream. I mean, no matter how, it is very depressing. You know, we come to this country, the media gives us such a big hassle. This discussion, how is your tour? I mean, as an example, how is your tour and book being embraced by the mainstream media? How is that going along?
We haven't had any hits from large mainstream sources for reviews, but Publishers Weekly and Kirkus Reviews, which are, you know, mainstream literary reviews, they've both given it exceptionally good reviews. So,
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think anybody who does take the time to read it, and I'm going to do what I can to help push it among some mainstream writers, because they should be writing about it, they should be reading it, because, you know, we anything that's written about Israel gets focused, you know, thousands of reviews all the time. Something this good about Palestine, and you really did do a great job. Pamela, listen, we're running out of time in this segment, but I just want to thank you for taking the time to come on board and to tell you that you've probably done one of the better things that I've seen done to bring the story of Palestinians. And I'm glad you did it, and I really did enjoy it.
And thank you so much for your efforts and for all the people around the world who are trying to help the Palestinians. It's such a just cause, and it needs the help of open-minded people, especially the young people of this world.
Just to be fair, just to tell the story, and I think that's what Pamela
signs, just to be fair, you're right.
Right. So, all right, Pamela, listen, thank you so much. Any final plugs? Your website is PamOlson.org. Anything else you want to say? Shout outs to anybody? Or?
I just want to, you know, say that it's really my pleasure to be able to tell the story. It's something that really was burning away at me to try to, you know, this thing that I experienced, these people that I met that were so gracious and so amazing in so many ways, totally opened their country to me, even though at the time I wasn't a writer, I wasn't a journalist, I was just an ignorant American traveler. And, you know, I try to explain it through the course of the book. It's difficult to explain it quickly, but you know, what they've given me in life, I can never repay. So it's my pleasure.
All right, Pam Olson, our guest. Her website is pamolson.org. Pam, we look forward to, you know, maybe talking to you sometime in the future. And certainly, I hope you're going to write some more because your writing is very good. And our listeners out there in Metro Detroit, I hope you go out and buy the book. I mean, not just because it's about Palestine, but it's a great read. It really is a compelling book. Thanks, Pam.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. This is Radio Ballady. It's about 29 minutes after the hour. We're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more. I think we maybe want to talk about Egypt's President Morsi, maybe about the anger that the Syrian government has with Jordan and Turkey, you know, for siding with the rebels. And then I think we got a few other issues we can talk about. The open letter to King Abdullah.
Yeah, there are so many issues to talk about. I think we need a show for the whole day.
So 5 hours, yeah.
10 hours, maybe. But let's
all
squeeze
right.
them all in 1 hour.
All right, I'm Ray Hanania.
And I'm Ali Yunus.
And we're going to be back right after these messages.
Ziad Brand. Quality products from our family to yours. Ziad Brothers Importing offers the finest quality products, including brands like Sultan, Kraft, Nestle, Hook, Rico Picon, Donna, and many more. Ask your retailer to carry these fine products because you deserve the very best. For more information, visit our website at www.ziad.com. That's www.ziad.com. Ziad, quality products from our family to yours.
Jake's Candy, 2-for-$1 candy bags and $1 candy bags available, wholesale and distribution. Jake's Candy has been satisfying the sweet tooth of thousands of people for over a decade, now providing delivery service to Columbus, Cincinnati, and Dayton, Ohio, as well as Rochester and Buffalo, New York, and New York City. For New York service, call Sully at 718-213-1264, or for more information, call Jake's Candy at 248-747-2223. That's 248-747-2223.
It was my job to save people. Until one night, I was in a car accident. I couldn't work, and the insurance company, they fought me every step of the way. I didn't know what to do.
Call 866-YOUR-RIGHTS.
I'm Shumana Kehus. I know what it's like to be refused your right. When you call, my attorneys and I will fight to get you the compensation you deserve.
Shumana handled my medical benefits and lost wages, and she got me a settlement.
If you have been injured, call 866-YOUR-RIGHTS.
منتجات زياد من عائلتنا إلى عائلتكم أفضل المنتجات الغذائية على الإطلاق ماركات سلطان كرافت نسلي بوك ريجو بيكان دانا بالإضافة إلى مجموعة أكبر من المنتجات الغذائية التي تحبها تجدها في كافة المحلات للمزيد من المعلومات قم بزيارة موقعنا زياد.com منتجات زياد من عائلتنا إلى عائلتكم.
And welcome back to Radio Ballady. I'm Ray Hanania.
I'm Ali Yunus.
And Ali, what do you think is the big topic this week in the Middle East? Is it Morsi?
There are so many big topics in the Middle East, Ray. So many big topics. Egypt dominates the news, but also Syria is all over the place. And all these two big countries, you know, the ripple effect when it comes, whatever happens in Egypt happens across the Arab world. The Arab world reacts at what happens in Syria, as it has been happening for the past 2 years. It's taken a toll on the Arab psyche and how it deals, whether to go proceed with the protest against the remaining dictators or the remaining authoritarian regimes in the region, or to stay put and settle with what you have instead of going to be breaking apart and becoming a failed country, as it increasingly happened to Syria, unfortunately, and in Egypt as well.
What happened to the Arab Spring? That was the big topic for 2 years in the mainstream American media, and now it's kind of like fizzled. I mean, is the Arab Spring still springing, or has democracy soured? You know, maybe the people don't believe that we're going to be able to bring democracy to the Arab world, which I don't think is going to happen easily or quickly. I think it can, but it's going to go through some rough.
Well, you're right. You're right. The Arab Spring fizzled away from the mainstream American media. I mean, I know from first-hand experience that the American media treats what's going on in Syria as, okay, it's the same thing over and over. What's right. happening in Egypt, the same thing over and over. It doesn't take, it's not occupying international news anymore. And because it's not romantic anymore. It's not, you know, breaking news with Tahrir Square, millions of people out there, and Hosni Mubarak resigned or not to resign. In Syria, it's a slaughterhouse, but at the same time, it's the military conflict there is standing at standstill. No one is able to overcome or defeat the other. With both sides are being armed by different groups. The rebels are being armed by Arab states and to a lesser extent by Western countries, whereas the Syrian regime has been armed by Iran, Russia, and China. And that, right. you know, in the middle is the Syrian people as a whole, and they are the ones that are being slaughtered on a daily basis, and their homes and towns and villages are being destroyed upon themselves. So the Syrian and the Arab world is divided. What to make of the Syrian regime? If Bashar al-Assad falls, many progressive or leftist or nationalist Arab thinkers or Arab populations in general think Syria will be moved toward the American camp and with it Israel. And that's a legitimate concern. Versus the others who say, well, if we have democracy, if we are free, this has come first to us, as opposed to thinking which camp we should be on, which side we should be on the Arab-Israeli conflict. And I'm sure they will be on the side of the Palestinian, because all the Syrian people, you know, are part of the conflict, whether they like it or not. And, you know, they lived it. And the Golan Heights is still occupied. We call the Golan Heights in Arabic, of course. So, and that's why it is confusing. Conflict for many people around the world, and it's a conflict that has divided the Arab world for the better or worse.
Well, first of all, I think I don't think you can call it the Golan Heights anymore. I think it's called Northern Israel. The Syrians have never done anything to take back that land except, you know, big talking and, you know, loudmouth bragging with no real action. But in Egypt, the president of Egypt decided that he didn't like some criticism that was directed at him from a TV talk show host who tried to use satire to criticize him. Bassem Youssef, I think, was his name.
Yeah.
And Youssef, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
It just seemed like the Morsi's government, rather than reacting, you know, the right way to Bassem Youssef's criticism, they just hammered him the way they would as if they were a dictatorship. But also at the same time, you know, some of Bassem Youssef's criticism was very pointed and harsh. It's almost like neither side really understands, you know, what democracy really means. It means you criticize people, but the intent of the criticism should be to make things better, not to, you know, burn things down or tear things down.
Right, right. And I think this is a characteristic of all transitional societies that are being transitioned from dictatorship for 50 or 60 or 100 years, in the case of the Arab world, into an open and free democratic societies. So the people are, you know, there's no well-established tradition of how you criticize the government and how the government reacts to this type of criticism. So both sides are going perhaps to the extreme end of this mechanism of democracy and how democracy works. But in the case of Bassem Youssef, you know, I believe, okay, he has the right to criticize, he has the right to ridicule, as long as it's within the boundaries of reasonable criticism. It's of good taste, I should say, as well. And not to go overboard, which does not justify taking him to jail or to imprison.
Right.
In this country, America, you could say anything about Barack Obama short of a threatening of killing him in writing or verbally, because that's a crime under the U.S. law. But you can make fun of him all day. You know, but mainstream media does not do that. You could find people who make fun of Obama on racial grounds.
Yeah, but we're talking about democracy 237 years after it started in the United States. I mean, it's easy today to say, oh, we can say whatever we want about the president. But I'll tell you what, when they started democracy in the United States, you know, 230 years ago, and had only been 7 years old, you couldn't criticize George Washington and, you know, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson like that. They'd shoot you, and they'd kill you. And, you know, this idea that Americans think that, oh, just because we've progressed, you know, we've advanced, you know, if you're not at the same level of democracy, democracy could take Egypt maybe 20 years, 30 years before they actually get it right. So why are we so harsh against Morsi, and all of a sudden the mainstream media wants to defend Bassem Youssef? If this guy Bassem Youssef had stood up and defended Palestinians, everybody in the United States would hate the guy. But because he's criticizing an Egyptian leader who they think is going to be critical of Israel, suddenly they, you know, I mean, he's being used, I think, don't you think?
Well, I beg to differ a little bit here, Ray, and please allow me, because, you know, sometimes I'm afraid to disagree with you.
Oh, baloney, you've been doing all the talking this morning. Go ahead.
Well, what I'm trying to say is, during George Washington's time, all, you know, past American presidents, they were lively press. You know, in part of the American Constitution, freedom of press is an integral part of having a democracy. Without free press, which means criticism of government, watching
and
the government. And
there's nothing like that in any Arab country.
That's true. So, and George Washington, actually, there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution says at that time that the presidential term should be limited to 2 terms. President Washington, you know, decided that by tradition he should step down after 2 terms.
Right. And that didn't happen, and they didn't have term limits until after Roosevelt.
Yes, until the 1950s. So it was a tradition, all the U.S. presidents, you know, from the 1700s until 1950s, that limited. So what I'm trying to say, it evolved, like you said. But does that mean that we in the Arab world should go back 200 years and start from point zero? What, American democracy started?
No, and that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that it takes time. I'm saying that the guy's only been president for 1 year.
Yeah, but
and elected democratically by a majority of people, and whether you like that majority or not, and I don't mean you, I mean people out there, they should live with it and use the rights. And I'm not justifying his crackdown on Bassem Youssef. What I'm saying is that we expect it to happen like, wow, it should be done now. We got it. It's here. That's not the reality. It takes time to make it work.
It does take time, and I think the Muslim Brotherhood, or as an organization, are once they got into power, they found themselves in a rude awakening. When they were outside power, opposition, secret and open group, or open secret group, you know, they were anti-Israel. They say, well, this Camp David treaty should be abolished.
Right.
You know, the Mubarak regime is an agent of the West, of America, and Israel. He is.
And wasn't he? They were accurate.
They were.
He was.
But look what happened today.
Bought off.
They continued in the same footsteps of Mubarak, because once you are in power, reality sets in. And I think that.
No. But see, listen, isn't it true that when anybody in government, even in a democracy, you're telling me George Bush was any worse or less worse than Morsi? George Bush was democratically elected for 8 years. He had the most oppressive government that this country's had in a long time. You know what? That's part of government. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood is no different than the right-wing Republican Party.
Yes.
You know, and what's the difference? So that's democracy. Maybe people didn't expect this.
But under George Bush, he did not try to have all the Republicans dominate all levers of power in America. He did not try to hide. But he had a cabinet, of course, but he did not.
He shoved the war down our throats. There was no Democratic vote. They were bullied into supporting a war in Iraq that had nothing to do with September 11th.
There were some special circumstances, right? I mean, you know, it was psychological, it was an emotional, and the U.S. Congress to sign in the Patriot Act, as you remember. And
well, isn't that what the Arab world is like now, psychological and emotional? I mean, we're going through an Arab spring that's driven by emotion.
You are right, but we live in a different era, Ray. We cannot compare ourselves to a country that 200 years ago did not have complete democracy. Today it's a modern world. I think President Morsi should have relaxed. He should have cooperated with the opposition. He should work with the others in a coalition government. But instead, and this is a problem to me, and this, I'm not saying that because I oppose him. I'm in favor of democracy. I'm in favor of having the Muslim Brotherhood have their chance to rule if they are democratically elected by the Egyptian people. What I'm trying to say is that he tried to take over, you know, and exclude others. When you try to exclude others, you become a semi-dictator.
Yeah, but no. Not when you're in a democracy, your whole purpose is to use the system to exclude others. What do you think the Democrats are trying to do now? They want to exclude the Republicans because they're Republicans are being obstructionists. You want to exclude people that are all these. Listen, Allie, all these things, in my opinion, are typical democracy. They're typical instruments of democracy, but we're still trying to interpret them as if this were a dictatorship. And Egypt is not a dictatorship, so we need to redefine how we assess what happens in Egypt, but not everybody wants to do that.
Well, you're right, but I think democracy in Egypt is going to take a long time, of course, to take place. And I think part of the confusion is that neither the Muslim Brotherhood nor the opposition group, most of the secular and left and nationalist groups, and the Egyptian people in general, they see themselves in a zero-sum game. Either I am in power alone and I can control the whole thing, or not.
Right.
So I think that's the idea of compromise and work together is problematic. In American, the U.S. election, every 4 years, you will never see a House majority of U.S. Congress and the Senate, where you have 90 Republicans and 10 Democrats, or 90 Democrats and 10 Republicans. You all see them close, a 10 to 15 difference. And the same thing with the U.S. House. And we worked in elections campaigns before here in this country, and we know that the American people could not deliver a total majority for one party, because that would be unthinkable. It would become a dictatorship of one party. But even at that, it'll be for 4 years, and that's about it.
And we also know that at voting time, only a small minority of people actually vote. Only a small minority of Americans participate in democracy. Morsi's government got more of a mandate to be president of Egypt than any president in the United States.
51%. That's what do you mean?
No. I'm talking about a plurality. He had like 80% of the voters voted. In the United States, we get what? 40% of the voters vote?
Yeah.
45? We get half as many people actually vote. And even though he only got 51%, that's still considered a significant victory. 2% of the vote over his rival. That is considered significant.
Yes. Well, it also shows that the Egyptian society was so polarized when 80% of the population voted, which is great. You know, 80% of those who have the right to vote voted.
Right.
And
it was better than what we've ever seen in the United States.
Well, that's true. I mean, in the United States, you've been doing that for
100 years. Well, that's my point.
You know,
that's my
point.
So this
is the first time everybody.
That's my point. Isn't that my point that I'm making, that we should give this guy some slack? Is he going to make mistakes? Sure. So did George Washington. Listen, we got to take a real quick break, though, Allie. This is a great debate, but I hate to, kind of stop it real quick. But we have to because we got one more break we got to do. I'm Ray Hannon.
I'm Allie Eunice.
And you're listening to Radio Ballady here at WNZK AM 690 Radio. Go online to RadioBallady.com. We'll be right back right after these messages.
Ziad Brand. Quality products from our family to yours. Ziad Brothers Importing offers the finest quality products, including brands like Sultan, Kraft, Nestle, Hook, Rico Picon, Donna, and many more. Ask your retailer to carry these fine products because you deserve the very best. For more information, visit our website at www.ziad.com. That's www.ziad.com. Ziad, quality products from our family to yours.
The American Muslim Center works for the community. It establishes goodness, virtue, and develops relationships between the Muslim communities as well as regional and national non-Muslim communities. The American Muslim Center on Outer Drive in Dearborn. Call 313-565-9314 or visit AmericanMuslimCenter.org.
If you get into a car accident, how will you pick up the pieces when you can't work, when the bills pile up? Who will help you? Call 866-YOUR-RIGHTS.
I called Jumana. She took care of everything. My medical bill, lost wages, and even a large settlement.
I am Jumana Kirus, and I assure you that my team will not stop until you get the most for your rights.
If you've been in a car accident, call Jumana, 866-YOUR-RIGHT.
منتجات زياد من عائلتنا إلى عائلتكم. أفضل المنتجات الغذائية على الإطلاق. ماركات سلطان، كرافت، نسلي، بوك، ريجل، بيكان، دانا. بالإضافة إلى مجموعة أكبر من المنتجات الغذائية التي تحبها تجدها في كافة المحلات. للمزيد من المعلومات قم بزيارة موقعنا زياد.com. منتجات زياد من عائلتنا إلى عائلتكم.
And welcome back to Radio Ballady. I'm Ray Hanania.
And I'm Ali Younes.
Ali, what else do we have? Did we beat that topic up about Egypt enough?
Yes, we could never finish talking about Egypt.
No, it's true. I think you're right. Yeah. What else do you got going?
Well, today, you know, what's going on in Syria and in Jordan, of course. But, you know,
I thought King Abdullah was always close to Bashar al-Assad.
He was, because when King Abdullah became a king in 1999, and that's the time when Bashar al-Assad also came about, and King Mohammed VI of Morocco, so the three young guys, became, you know, leaders of their countries, took over after their fathers. You know, it's ironic. I understand monarchy, that
right.
you can inherit the throne, the office, but in a republic of Syria, he inherited the office from his father. So,
well, even in a monarchy in the Arab world, they're basically dictatorships too, because unlike in Britain, the monarchy is a little independent.
I can't say dictatorship in a sense like Saddam Hussein was or Bashar al-Assad. They are authoritarian regimes. They
authoritarian is like a dictatorship.
Well, yes, it is, but with violence, with varied degrees, I should say, because I cannot, you know, paint the whole thing with one brush. When there are,
it's not the most harsh dictatorship,
yes.
But the Arab world monarchy,
but Saudi Arabia, for example,
not like the monarchy in Britain,
okay.
For example.
Well, look, if you are a citizen of Qatar or Bahrain, you know, maybe half of the population of Bahrain, not all of them, but UAE or Kuwait, I don't think you are suffering from the dictatorship of the regime. I mean,
you are
benefiting.
Stand up and run for office and take control of the country.
Well, the economic part of it, I mean, you are benefiting. You get free loans. Sometimes you get free money, free education, free healthcare, free everything. So that's that part is great. But at
Bribery.
The same time, yes. But at the same time, you have no political rights. You have no rights whatsoever to speak out or establish a newspaper. Or to criticize the government, or choose...
Or to question the government.
Or question,
nobody knows what they do.
Yeah, or
do you know
what kind of government they would like to be governed with.
Do you know how King Abdullah spends his money? Do we have any idea?
Which King Abdullah are you talking about?
In Jordan. I mean, he claims to be Western. You know, the other King Abdullah doesn't claim to be Western.
Right.
The other King Abdullah doesn't claim to be Democratic.
Well, you know,
But King Abdullah in Jordan says, yeah, he's Democratic and... moving towards democracy.
Yeah, moving toward democracy, and that's why I published a letter, and I hope...
It's like me driving to Los Angeles. It's going to take me a long time.
Well, look what happens in Egypt. Yes, it will take a long time, and I am in favor of that, but we have to start somewhere, you know. We cannot say we'll never get that without even put ourselves behind the wheel and start driving toward democracy.
So shouldn't we, though, be patient, though, knowing that, you know, this isn't going to happen overnight?
No, we should be working toward it. All of us should be working. That's why my letter to King Abdullah, encouraging and urging him to moving toward democracy, because I think when the king, a sovereign monarch, a king, a head of a state, says something, we should hold him to it. We should say, well, you said that, and we agree with it, and that's what we want.
Right.
And we should move forward, because in Jordan, for example, there are forces... conservative or right-wing Jordanians who think that democracy is a threat, who think liberalism when it comes to political rights is a threat. They think if they have voting rights or social justice is a threat to their interests, to their benefits, and dividing the population, Palestinian versus Jordanian, Muslim versus Christian, this is immature, and this is a thing of the past, and it should be a thing of the past. I think up to the Jordanian people, the enlightened ones, at least the intellectuals, I should say, move forward and push that agenda by helping the king's opinions. And I'm not trying to say I'm a monarchist. You know, I'm trying to do what's best for Jordan. According to what I see it, you know, I might be wrong, but this is what I see today, and I hope a lot of people agree with me on that, and I hope you agree with me, and I know you agree with me.
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, listen, I would like to see Jordan become more democratic. I'd like to see all the Arab countries become more democratic, but I know it's not going to happen overnight. So I think we can continue to support their governments as long as they start lifting, you know, the suppression of individual rights. And the people need to recognize that they have a responsibility. You can't just go protest and destroy something. You know, you can protest, but you don't want to be destructive and say, let's bring this government down and let's bring, you know, because my leader didn't win, I won't support what we're doing.
Yeah, that's right. I think there should be a condition for us to support the government. We should support the government or the regime so long as this regime is moving toward democracy.
And they follow the law.
And they follow the law, not above the law. And in my letter, there's an English version of it. In it, I actually specify more legal nuances according to international law, because I call for the rule of law. In Arabic, I don't know what's the tradition there as far as Islamic law, jurisprudence. What does it say about a country that is ruled by law, not ruled through law? Because the rule of law, the law is supreme. The law is the governor of the land, whereas the king or the president is a servant of that law. He is the executive of that law. He is the implementer of that law. If you have the monarchy in, for example, Morocco, they say, oh, we have a constitutional monarchy, but the king is an executive of the law, which means he has executive power over the law. Well, that is a danger because it puts the monarch above the law. So the rule of law excludes the monarch from being above the law, and it puts the monarch, the king or the president, and everybody else under the law, ruled by law. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and it would be nice if that were the case. But
it is the case in Europe, Dutch monarchy, English monarchy.
There's some, there's some exceptions.
I mean, Queen Elizabeth is not above the law. In fact,
right. The
English national anthem, it says, you know, God save the Queen to protect our laws.
And that's the kind of monarchy that I think would be great in the Arab world.
Yeah,
but what king,
I think,
what Arab king or leader is going to give up their power? You know, he has absolute power. His voice rules. He can throw out the parliament anytime he wants. He could change the laws. I mean, so it's not up to the people. They have a voice, but that's not good enough. Is he changing in the context of my argument that I made earlier that, you know, democracy takes a while, and in Jordan it's taking time, and it's moving that way? Is it?
I think, you know, look, my theory on this is this. I think we should take advantage of King Abdullah opening up, you know, the debate, and we should engage in this debate.
Right.
As citizens of this country or that country, allow the king or the president to single-handedly decide the fate of the country, it's a mistake. It is we, the people, should encourage that king and support him if he moves in that direction, and oppose him for not going into that direction. Because, look, dictatorships, monarchies, they'll be, it's a thing of the past. You cannot rule a country anymore with monarchy the way it is ruled today as an absolutist. In the 60s, 50s, or even 70s, all what it takes to topple a regime, occupy the radio station and the TV station, and you are in power. All you have to announce, and you get the military support you. Now, you can occupy the Jordan TV, the radio station, anywhere, and the regime will not fall, because people have Facebook, people have Twitter, people have iPhone, people listen. They're not going to listen to you, communicate number one, and you, all of a sudden you are rule of the country. It takes more than that to change the regime.
All right. Listen, we got to go. This is the end of our show here at Radio Ballady. We're going to be back next week, same time, 8 o'clock on WNZK AM 690. I'm Ray Hanania. And we'll catch up with you again. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
We